time of St. Augustine. Besides, there is still more convincing proof in the fact that the same father establishes the truth of witchcraft in all his writings, and more particularly in his City of God, and in his first volume, Question the 25th, wherein he states that sorcery is a communion between man and the devil, which all good Christians ought to look upon with horror. Taking all these things into consideration, sire, the officers of your parliament hope from the justice of your majesty that you will be graciously pleased to receive the humble remonstrances they have taken the liberty to make. They are compelled, for the acquittal of their own consciences and in discharge of their duty, to make known to your majesty that the decrees they passed against the sorcerers and witches brought before them were passed after a mature deliberation on the part of all the judges present, and that nothing has been done therein which is not conformable to the universal jurisprudence of the kingdom, and for the general welfare of your majesty's subjects, of whom there is not one who can say that he is secure from the malevolence of such criminals. We therefore supplicate your majesty to suffer us to carry into effect the sentences we passed, and to proceed with the trial of the other persons accused of the same crime, and that the piety of your majesty will not suffer to be introduced during your reign an opinion contrary to the principles of that holy religion for which you have always employed so gloriously both your cares and your arms. Louis, as we have already mentioned, paid no attention to this appeal. The lives of the old women were spared, and prosecutions for mere witchcraft, unconnected with other offenses, were discontinued throughout France. In 1680, an act was passed for the punishment not of witches, but of pretenders to witchcraft, fortune-tellers, divineresses, and poisoners. Thus the light broke in upon Germany, France, England, and Scotland about the same time, gradually growing clearer and clearer till the middle of the 18th century, when witchcraft was finally reckoned amongst exploded doctrines, and the belief in it confined to the uttermost vulgar. Twice, however, did the madness burst forth again as furious while it lasted as ever it had been, the first time in Sweden in 1669, and the second in Germany so late as 1749. Both these instances merit particular mention. The first one is of the most extraordinary upon record, and for atrocity and absurdity is unsurpassed in the annals of any nation. It having been reported to the King of Sweden that the little village of Mora in the province of Dalecarlia was troubled exceedingly with witches, he appointed a commission of clergy and laymen to trace the rumor to its source, with full powers to punish the guilty. On the 12th of August, 1669, the commissioners arrived in the bewitched village to the great joy of the credulous inhabitants. On the following day, the whole population, amounting to 3,000 persons, assembled in the church. A sermon was preached, declaring the miserable case of those people that suffered themselves to be deluded by the devil, and fervent prayer was offered up that God should remove the scourge from among them. The whole assembly then adjourned it to the rector's house, filling all the street before it, when the king's commission was read, charging every person who knew anything of the witchery to come forward and declare the truth. A passion of tears seized upon the multitude. Men, women, and children began to weep and sob, and all promised to divulge what they had heard or knew. In this frame of mind, they were dismissed to their homes. On the following day, they were again called together, when the depositions of several persons were taken publicly before them all. The result was that 70 persons, including 15 children, were taken into custody. Numbers also were arrested in the neighboring district of Elfdale. Being put to the torture, they all confessed their guilt. They said they used to go to a gravel pit that lay hard by the crossway, where they put a vest upon their heads and danced round and round and round about. They then went to the crossway and called three times upon the devil, the first time in a low, still voice, the second somewhat louder, and the third very loudly, with these words, "Antecessor, come and carry us to Blockula." This invocation never failed to bring him to their view. He generally appeared as a little old man in a gray coat with red and blue stockings, with exceedingly long garters. He had besides a very high-crowned hat with bands of many-colored linen enfolded about it, and a long red beard that hung down to his middle. The first question he put to them was whether they would serve him soul and body. On their answering in the affirmative, he told them to make ready for the journey to Blockula. It was necessary to procure, in the first place, some scrapings of altars and filings of church clocks. Antecessor then gave them a horn with some salve in it, wherewith they anointed themselves. These preparations ended, he brought beasts for them to ride upon, horses, asses, goats, and monkeys, and giving them a saddle, a hammer, and a nail, uttered the word of command, and away they went. Nothing stopped them. They flew over churches, high walls, rocks, and mountains, until they came to the green meadow where Blockula was situated. Upon these occasions they carried as many children with them as they could. For the devil, they said, did plague and whip them if they did not procure him children, insomuch as they had no peace or quiet for him. Many parents corroborated a part of this evidence, stating that their children had repeatedly told them that they had been carried away in the night to Blockula, where the devil had beaten them black and blue. They had seen the marks in the morning, but they soon disappeared. One little girl was examined, who swore positively that she was carried through the air by the witches, and when at a great height she uttered the holy name of Jesus. She immediately fell to the ground and made a great hole in her side. The devil, however, picked her up, healed her side, and carried her away to Blockula. She added, and her mother confirmed her statement, that she had till that day an exceeding great pain in her side. This was a clencher, and the nail of conviction was driven home to the hearts of the judges. The place called Blockula, whither they were carried, was a large house with a gate to it, in a delicate meadow, whereof they could see no end. There was a very long table in it, at which the witches sat down, and in other rooms there were very lovely and delicate beds for them to sleep upon. After a number of ceremonies had been performed, by which they were bound themselves body and soul to the service of Antecessor, they sat down to a feast composed of broth, made of coleworts and bacon, oatmeal, bread and butter, milk and cheese. The devil always took the chair, and sometimes played to them on the harp or the fiddle while they were eating. After dinner they danced in a ring, sometimes naked and sometimes in their clothes, cursing and swearing all the time. Some of the women added particulars too horrible and too obscene for repetition. Once the devil pretended to be dead so that he might see whether his people regretted him. They instantly set up a loud wail and wept three tears each for him, at which he was so pleased that he jumped up among them and hugged in his arms those who had been most obstreperous in their sorrow. Such were the principal details given by the children and corroborated by the confessions of the full-grown witches. Anything more absurd was never before stated in a court of justice. Many of the accused contradicted themselves most palpably, but the commissioners gave no heed to discrepancies. One of them, the parson of the district, stated in the course of the inquiry that on a particular night which he mentioned he had been afflicted with a headache so agonizing that he could not account for it otherwise than by supposing he was bewitched. In fact, he thought a score of witches must have been dancing on the crown of his head. This announcement excited great horror among the pious dames of the auditory, who loudly expressed their wonder that the devil should have power to hurt so good a man. One poor witch, who lay in the very jaws of death, confessed that she knew too well the cause of the minister's headache. The devil had sent her with a sledgehammer and a large nail to drive into the good man's skull. She had hammered at it for some time, but the skull was so enormously thick that she made no impression upon it. Every hand was held up in astonishment. The pious minister blessed God that his skull was so solid, and he became renowned for his thick head all the days of his life. Whether the witch intended a joke does not appear, but she was looked upon as a criminal more than usually atrocious. 70 persons were condemned to death on these so awful yet so ridiculous confessions. 23 of them were burned together in one fire in the village of Mora, in the presence of thousands of delighted spectators. On the following day, 15 children were murdered in the same manner, offered up in sacrifice to the bloody Moloch of superstition. The remaining 32 were executed at the neighboring town of Faluna. Besides these, 56 children were found guilty of witchcraft in a minor degree, and sentenced to various punishments, such as running the gauntlet, imprisonment, and public whipping once a week for a 12-month. Long after the occurrence of this case, it was cited as one of the most convincing proofs upon record of the prevalence of witchcraft. When men wish to construct or support a theory, how they torture facts into their service. The lying whimsies of a few sick children, encouraged by foolish parents and drawn out by superstitious neighbors, were sufficient to set a country in a flame. If, instead of commissions as deeply sunk in the slough of ignorance as the people they were sent amongst, there had been deputed a few men firm in courage and clear in understanding, how different would have been the result? Some of the poor children who were burned would have been sent to an infirmary. Others would have been well flogged. The credulity of the parents would have been laughed at, and the lives of 70 persons spared. The belief in witchcraft remains in Sweden to this day, but happily the annals of that country present no more such instances of lamentable aberration of intellect as the one just cited. In New England, about the same time, the colonists were scared by similar stories of the antics of the devil. All at once a fear seized upon the multitude, and supposed criminals were arrested day after day in such numbers that the prisons were found too small to contain them. A girl named Goodwin, the daughter of a mason who was hypochondriac and subject to fits, imagined that an old Irish woman named Glover had bewitched her. Her two brothers, in whose constitutions there was apparently a predisposition to similar fits, went off in the same way, crying out that the devil and Dame Glover were tormenting them. At times their joints were so stiff that they could not be moved, while at others, said the neighbors, they were so flexible that the bones appeared softened into sinews. The supposed witch was seized, and as she could not repeat the Lord's Prayer without making a mistake in it, she was condemned and executed. But the popular excitement was not allayed. One victim was not enough. The people waited agape for new disclosures. Suddenly, two hysteric girls in another family fell into fits daily, and the cry of witchcraft resounded from one end of the colony to the other. The feeling of suffocation in the throat, so common in cases of hysteria, was said by the patients to be caused by the devil himself, who had stuck balls in the windpipe to choke them. They felt the pricking of thorns in every part of the body, and one of them vomited needles. The case of these girls, who were the daughter and niece of a Mr. Parvis, the minister of a Calvinist chapel, excited so much attention that all the weak women in the colony began to fancy themselves similarly afflicted. The more they brooded on it, the more convinced they became. The contagion of this mental disease was as great as if it had been a pestilence. One after the other, the women fainted away, asserting on their recovery that they had seen the specters of witches. Where there were three or four girls in a family, they so worked each upon the diseased imagination of the other that they fell into fits five or six times in a day. Some related that the devil himself appeared to them, bearing in his hand a parchment roll, and promising that if they would sign an agreement transferring to him their immortal souls, they should be immediately relieved from fits and all the ills of the flesh. Others asserted that they saw witches only, who made them similar promises, threatening that they should never be free from aches and pains till they had agreed to become the devils. When they refused, the witches pinched or bit or pricked them with long pins and needles. More than 200 persons named by these mischievous visionaries were thrown into prison. They were of all ages and conditions of life, and many of them of exemplary character. No less than 19 were condemned and executed before reason returned to the minds of the colonists. The most horrible part of this lamentable history is that among the victims there was a little child only 5 years old. Some women swore that they had seen it repeatedly in company with the devil, and that it had bitten them often with its little teeth for refusing to sign a compact with the evil one. It can hardly increase our feelings of disgust and abhorrence when we learn that this insane community actually tried and executed a dog for the same offense. One man named Corey stoutly refused to plead to the preposterous indictment against him. As was the practice in such cases, he was pressed to death. It is told of the sheriff of New England, who superintended the execution, that when this unhappy man thrust out his tongue in his mortal agony, he seized hold of a cane and crammed it back again into the mouth. If ever there were a fiend in human form, it was this sheriff, a man who, if the truth were known, perhaps plumed himself upon his piety, thought he was doing God good service, and hoped to merit heaven by making earth a hell. Arguing still in the firm belief of witchcraft, the bereaved people began to inquire when they saw their dearest friends snatched away from them by these wide-spreading accusations, whether the whole proceedings were not carried on by the agency of the devil. Might not the great enemy have put false testimony into the mouths of the witnesses? Or might not the witnesses be witches themselves? Every man who was in danger of losing his wife, his child, or his sister embraced this doctrine with avidity. The revulsion was as sudden as the first frenzy. All at once the colonists were convinced of their error. The judges put a stop to the prosecutions, even of those who had confessed their guilt. The latter were no sooner at liberty than they retracted all they had said, and the greater number hardly remembered the avowals which agony had extorted from them. 8 persons who had been tried and condemned were set free, and gradually girls ceased to have fits and to talk of the persecutions of the devil. The judge who had condemned the first criminal executed on this charge was so smitten with sorrow and humiliation at his folly that he set apart the anniversary of that day as one of solemn penitence and fasting. He still clung to the belief in witchcraft. No new light had broken in upon him on that subject, but happily for the community, the delusion had taken a merciful turn. The whole colony shared the feeling. The jurors on the different trials openly expressed their penitence in the churches, and those who had suffered were regarded as the victims and not as the accomplices of Satan. It is related that the Indian tribes in New England were sorely puzzled at the infatuation of the settlers, and thought them either a race inferior to or more sinful than the French colonists in the vicinity, amongst whom, as they remarked, the Great Spirit sent no witches. Returning again to the continent of Europe, we find that after the year 1680, men became still wiser upon this subject. For 20 years the populace were left to their belief, but governments in general gave it no aliment in the shape of executions. The edict of Louis XIV gave a blow to the superstition, from which it never recovered. The last execution in the Protestant cantons of Switzerland was at Geneva in 1652. The various potentates of Germany, although they could not stay the trials, invariably commuted the sentences into imprisonment, in all cases where the pretended witch was accused of pure witchcraft, unconnected with any other crime. In the year 1701, Tomasius, the learned professor at the University of Halle, delivered his inaugural thesis, De Crimine Magiae, which struck another blow at the falling monster of popular error. But a faith so strong as that in witchcraft was not to be eradicated at once. The arguments of learned men did not penetrate to the villages and hamlets, but still they achieved great things. They rendered the belief an unworking faith and prevented the supply of victims, on which for so many ages it had battened and grown strong. Once more the delusion broke out. Like a wild beast wounded to the death, it collected all its remaining energies for the final convulsion, which was to show how mighty it had once been. Germany, which had nursed the frightful error in its cradle, tended it on its deathbed, and Würzburg, the scene of so many murders on the same pretext, was destined to be the scene of the last. That it might lose no portion of its bad renown, the last murder was as atrocious as the first. This case offers a great resemblance to that of the witches of Mora and New England, except in the number of its victims. It happened so late as the year 1749. To the astonishment and disgust of the rest of Europe. A number of young women in a convent at Würzburg fancied themselves bewitched. They felt, like all hysteric subjects, a sense of suffocation in the throat. They went into fits repeatedly, and one of them, who had swallowed needles, evacuated them at abscesses, which formed in different parts of the body. The cry of sorcery was raised, and a young woman named Maria Renata Singer was arrested on the charge of having leagued with the devil to bewitch 5 of the young ladies. It was sworn on the trial that Maria had been frequently seen to clamber over the convent walls in the shape of a pig, that proceeding to the cellar she used to drink the best wine till she was intoxicated, and then start suddenly up in her own form. Other girls asserted that she used to prowl about the roof like a cat, and often penetrate into their chamber and frighten them by her dreadful howlings. It was also said that she had been seen in the shape of a hare, milking the cows dry in the meadows belonging to the convent, that she used to perform as an actress on the boards of Drury Lane Theatre in London, and on the very same night return upon a broomstick to Würzburg, and afflict the young ladies with pains in all their limbs. Upon this evidence she was condemned and burned alive in the marketplace of Würzburg. Here ends this frightful catalogue of murder and superstition. Since that day the belief in witchcraft has fled from the populous abodes of men, and taken refuge in remote villages and districts too wild, rugged, and inhospitable to afford a resting place for the foot of civilization. Rude fishers and uneducated laborers still attribute every phenomenon of nature which they cannot account for to the devil and witches. Catalepsy, that wondrous disease, is still thought by ignorant gossips to be the work of Satan. And hypochondriacs, uninformed by science of the nature of their malady, devoutly believe in the reality of their visions. The reader would hardly credit the extent of the delusion upon this subject in the very heart of England at this day. Many an old woman leads a life of misery from the unfeeling insults of her neighbors, who raise the scornful finger and hooting voice at her, because in her decrepitude she is ugly, spiteful, perhaps insane, and realizes in her personal appearance the description preserved by tradition of the witches of yore. Even in the neighborhood of great towns, the taint remains of this once widely spread contagion. If no victims fall beneath it, the enlightenment of the law is all that prevents a recurrence of scenes as hard as those of the 17th century. Hundreds upon hundreds of witnesses could be found to swear to absurdities as great as those asserted by the infamous Matthew Hopkins. In the annual register for 1760, an instance of the belief in witchcraft is related, which shows how superstition lingers. A dispute arose in the little village of Glen in Leicestershire between two old women, each of whom vehemently accused the other of witchcraft. The quarrel at last ran so high that a challenge ensued, and they both agreed to be tried by the ordeal of swimming. They accordingly stripped to their shifts, procured some men who tied their thumbs and great toes together, crosswise, and then, with a cart rope about their middle, suffered themselves to be thrown into a pool of water. One of them sank immediately, but the other continued struggling a short time upon the surface of the water, which the mob deemed an infallible sign of her guilt, pulled her out, and insisted that she should immediately impeach all her accomplices in the craft. She accordingly told them that in the neighboring village of Burton there were several old women as much witches as she was. Happily for her, this negative information was deemed sufficient, and a student in astrology, or white witch, coming up at the time, the mob, by his direction, proceeded forthwith to Burton in search of all the delinquents. After a little consultation on their arrival, they went to the old woman's house on whom they had fixed the strongest suspicion. The poor old creature, on their approach, locked the outer door, and from the window of an upstairs room asked what they wanted. They informed her that she was charged with being guilty of witchcraft, and that they were come to duck her, remonstrating with her at the same time upon the necessity of submission to the ordeal, that if she were innocent, all the world might know it. Upon her persisting in a positive refusal to come down, they broke open the door and carried her out by force to a deep gravel pit full of water. They tied her thumbs and toes together and threw her into the water, where they kept her for several minutes, drawing her out and in two or three times by the rope round her middle. Not being able to satisfy themselves whether she were a witch or no, they at last let her go, or, more properly speaking, they left her on the bank to walk home by herself if she ever recovered. Next day they tried the same experiment upon another woman, and afterwards upon a third. But fortunately neither of the victims lost her life from this brutality. Many of the ringleaders in the outrage were apprehended during the week and tried before the justices at quarter sessions. Two of them were sentenced to stand in the pillory and to be imprisoned for a month, and as many as 20 more were fined in small sums for the assault and bound over to keep the peace for a 12-month. So late as the year 1785, says Arnott in his collection and abridgment of criminal trials in Scotland, it was the custom among the sect of seceders to read from the pulpit an annual confession of sins, national and personal, amongst the former of which was particularly mentioned the repeal by Parliament of the penal statute against witches, contrary to the express laws of God. Many houses are still to be found in England with the horseshoe, the grand preservative against witchcraft, nailed against the threshold. If any overwise philosopher should attempt to remove them, the chances are that he would have more broken bones than thanks for his interference. Let any man walk into Cross Street, Hatton Garden, and from thence into Bleeding Heart Yard, and learn the tales, still told and believed, of one house in that neighborhood, and he will ask himself in astonishment if such things can be in the 19th century. The witchcraft of Lady Hatton, the wife of the famous Sir Christopher, so renowned for his elegant dancing in the days of Elizabeth, is as devoutly believed as the Gospels. The room is to be seen where the devil seized her after the expiration of the contract he had made with her, and bore her away bodily to the pit of Tophet. The pump against which he dashed her is still pointed out, and the spot where her heart was found, after he had torn it out of her bosom with his iron claws, has received the name of Bleeding Heart Yard in confirmation of the story. Whether the horseshoe still remains upon the door of the haunted house to keep away other witches is uncertain. A former inmate relates that, about 20 years ago, more than one old woman begged for admittance repeatedly to satisfy themselves that it was in its proper place. One poor creature, apparently insane and clothed in rags, came to the door with a tremendous double knock, as loud as that of a fashionable footman, and walked straight along the passage to the horseshoe. Great was the wonderment of the inmates, especially when the woman spat upon the horseshoe, and expressed her sorrow that she could do no harm while it remained there. After spitting upon and kicking it again and again, she coolly turned round and left the house without saying a word to anybody. This poor creature perhaps intended a joke, but the probability is that she imagined herself a witch. In Saffron Hill, where she resided, her ignorant neighbors gave her that character and looked upon her with no little fear and aversion. More than one example of the popular belief in witchcraft occurred in the neighborhood of Hastings so lately as the year 1830. An aged woman who resided in the rope walk of that town was so repulsive in her appearance that she was invariably accused of being a witch by all the ignorant people who knew her. She was bent completely double, and though very old, her eye was unusually bright and malignant. She wore a red cloak and supported herself on a crutch. She was, to all outward appearance, the very beau ideal of a witch. So dear is power to the human heart that this old woman actually encouraged the popular superstition. She took no pains to remove the ill impression, but seemed to delight that she, old and miserable as she was, could keep in awe so many happier and stronger fellow creatures. Timid girls crouched with fear when they met her, and many would go a mile out of their way to avoid her. Like the witches of the olden time, she was not sparing of her curses against those who offended her. The child of a woman who resided within two doors of her was afflicted with lameness, and the mother constantly asserted that the old woman had bewitched her. All the neighbors credited the tale. It was believed, too, that she could assume the form of a cat. Many a harmless puss has been hunted almost to the death by mobs of men and boys, upon the supposition that the animal would start up before them in the true shape of Mother Blank. In the same town there resided a fisherman, who was the object of unceasing persecution because it was said that he had sold himself to the devil. It was currently reported that he could creep through a keyhole, and that he had made a witch of his daughter in order that he might have the more power over his fellows. It was also believed that he could sit on the points of pins and needles and feel no pain. His brother fishermen put him to this test whenever they had an opportunity. In the alehouses which he frequented, they often placed long needles in the cushions of the chairs, in such a manner that he could not fail to pierce himself when he sat down. The result of these experiments tended to confirm their faith in his supernatural powers. It was asserted that he never flinched. Such was the popular feeling in the fashionable town of Hastings a few years ago. Very probably it is the same now. In the north of England, the superstition lingers to an almost inconceivable extent. Lancashire abounds with witch doctors, a set of quacks who pretend to cure diseases inflicted by the devil. The practices of these worthies may be judged by the following case, reported in the Hartford Reformer of the 23rd of June, 1838. The witch doctor alluded to is better known by the name of the Cunning Man, and has a large practice in the counties of Lincoln and Nottingham. According to the writer in the Reformer, the dupe, whose name is not mentioned, had been for about 2 years afflicted with a painful abscess and had been prescribed for without relief by more than one medical gentleman. He was urged by some of his friends, not only in his own village but in neighboring ones, to consult the witch doctor, as they were convinced he was under some evil influence. He agreed and sent his wife to the Cunning Man, who lived in New St. Swithin's in Lincoln. She was informed by this ignorant impostor that her husband's disorder was an infliction of the devil occasioned by his next-door neighbors, who had made use of certain charms for that purpose. From the description he gave of the process, it appears to be the same as that employed by Dr. Fian and Gellie Duncan to work woe upon King James. He stated that the neighbors, instigated by a witch whom he pointed out, took some wax and molded it before the fire into the form of her husband, as near as they could represent him. They then pierced the image with pins on all sides, repeated the Lord's Prayer backwards, and offered prayers to the devil that he would fix his stings into the person whom that figure represented, in like manner as they pierced it with pins. To counteract the effects of this diabolical process, the witch doctor prescribed a certain medicine, and a charm to be worn next the body, on that part where the disease principally lay. The patient was to repeat the 109th and 119th Psalms every day, or the cure would not be effectual. The fee which he claimed for this advice was a guinea. So efficacious is faith in the cure of any malady that the patient actually felt much better after a 3 weeks' course of this prescription. The notable charm which the quack had given was afterwards opened and found to be a piece of parchment covered with some cabalistic characters and signs of the planets. The next-door neighbors were in great alarm that the witch doctor would, on the solicitation of the recovering patient, employ some means to punish them for their pretended witchcraft. To escape the infliction, they feed another cunning man in Nottinghamshire, who told them of a similar charm which would preserve them from all the malice of their enemies. The writer concludes by saying that the doctor, not long after he had been thus consulted, wrote to say that he had discovered that his patient was not afflicted by Satan, as he had imagined, but by God, and would continue more or less in the same state till his life's end. An impostor carried on a similar trade in the neighborhood of Tunbridge Wells about the year 1830. He had been in the practice for several years and charged enormous fees for his advice. This fellow pretended to be the seventh son of a seventh son, and to be endowed in consequence with miraculous powers for the cure of all diseases, but especially of those resulting from witchcraft. It was not only the poor who employed him, but ladies who rode in their carriages. He was often sent for from a distance of 60 or 70 miles by these people, who paid all his expenses to and fro, besides rewarding him handsomely. He was about 80 years of age, and his extremely venerable appearance aided his imposition in no slight degree. His name was Oakey or Oakley. In France, the superstition at this day is even more prevalent than it is in England. Garinet, in his History of Magic and Sorcery in that country, cites upwards of 20 instances which occurred between the years 1805 and 1818. In the latter year, no less than 3 tribunals were occupied with trials originating in this humiliating belief. We shall cite only one of them. Julien de Bourde, aged 53, a mason and inhabitant of the village of Toulouse, near Bordeaux, was taken suddenly ill in the month of January 1818. As he did not know how to account for his malady, he suspected at last that he was bewitched. He communicated this suspicion to his son-in-law, Bridier, and they both went to consult a sort of idiot named Baudouin, who passed for a conjurer or white witch. This man told them that Desbourdes was certainly bewitched and offered to accompany them to the house of an old man named Renard, who he said was undoubtedly the criminal. On the night of the 23rd of January, all three proceeded stealthily to the dwelling of Renard and accused him of afflicting persons with diseases by the aid of the devil. Desbourdes fell to his knees and earnestly entreated to be restored to his former health, promising that he would take no measures against him for the evil he had done. The old man denied in the strongest terms that he was a wizard, and when Desbourdes still pressed him to remove the spell from him, he said he knew nothing about the spell and refused to remove it. The idiot Baudouin, the white witch, now interfered, and told his companions that no relief for the malady could ever be procured until the old man confessed his guilt. To force him to confession, they lighted some sticks of sulfur which they had brought with them for the purpose and placed them under the old man's nose. In a few moments he fell down suffocated and apparently lifeless. They were all greatly alarmed, and thinking that they had killed the man, they carried him out and threw him into a neighboring pond, hoping to make it appear that he had fallen in accidentally. The pond, however, was not very deep, and the coolness of the water reviving the old man, he opened his eyes and sat up. Desbourdes and Bridier, who were still waiting on the bank, were now more alarmed than before, lest he should recover and inform against them. They therefore waded into the pond, seized their victim by the hair of the head, beat him severely, and then held him under water till he was drowned. They were all three apprehended on the charge of murder a few days afterwards. Desbourdes and Bridier were found guilty of aggravated manslaughter only, and sentenced to be burnt on the back and to work in the galleys for life. The white witch, Baudouin, was acquitted on the ground of insanity. Monsieur Garinet further informs us that France, at the time he wrote, 1818, was overrun by a race of fellows who made a trade of casting out devils and finding out witches. He adds also that many of the priests in the rural districts encouraged the superstition of their parishioners by resorting frequently to exorcisms whenever any foolish persons took it into their heads that a spell had been thrown over them. He recommended as a remedy for the evil that all these exorcists, whether lay or clerical, should be sent to the galleys, and felt assured that the number of witches would then very sensibly diminish. Many other instances of this lingering belief might be cited both in France and Great Britain, and indeed in every other country in Europe. So deeply rooted are some errors that ages cannot remove them. The poisonous tree that once overshadowed the land may be cut down by the sturdy efforts of sages and philosophers. The sun may shine clearly upon spots where venomous things once nestled in security and shade, but still the entangled roots are stretched beneath the surface and may be found by those who dig. Another king like James I might make them vegetate again. And, more mischievous still, another pope like Innocent VIII might raise the decaying roots to strength and verdure. Still, it is consoling to think that the delirium has passed away, that the raging madness has given place to a milder folly, and that we may now count by units the votaries of a superstition which in former ages numbered its victims by tens of thousands, and its votaries by millions. The Slow Poisoners. Piscara. The like was never read of. Stefano. In my judgment, to all that shall but hear it, 'twill appear a most impossible fable. Piscara. Troth, I'll tell you, and briefly as I can, by what degrees they fell into this madness. Duke of Milan. The atrocious system of poisoning by poisons so slow in their operation as to make the victim appear, to ordinary observers, as if dying from a gradual decay of nature, has been practiced in all ages. Those who are curious in the matter may refer to Beckmann on secret poisons in his History of Inventions, in which he has collected several instances of it from the Greek and Roman writers. Early in the 16th century, the crime seems to have gradually increased, till in the 17th it spread over Europe like a pestilence. It was often exercised by pretended witches and sorcerers, and finally became a branch of education amongst all who laid any claim to magical and supernatural arts. In the 21st year of Henry VIII, an act was passed rendering it high treason. Those found guilty of it were to be boiled to death. One of the first in point of date, and hardly second to any in point of atrocity, is the murder by this means of Sir Thomas Overbury, which disgraced the court of James I in the year 1613. A slight sketch of it will be a fitting introduction to the history of the poisoning mania, which was so prevalent in France and Italy 50 years later. Robert Carr, a Scottish youth, was early taken notice of by James I, and loaded with honors, for no other reason that the world could ever discover than the beauty of his person. James, even in his own day, was suspected of being addicted to the most abominable of all offenses, and the more we examine his history now, the stronger the suspicion becomes. However that may be, the handsome Carr, lending his smooth cheek even in public to the disgusting kisses of his royal master, rose rapidly in favor. In the year 1613, he was made Lord High Treasurer of Scotland, and created an English peer by the style and title of Viscount Rochester. Still further honors were in store for him. In this rapid promotion, he had not been without a friend, Sir Thomas Overbury, the king's secretary, who appears, from some threats in his own letters, to have been no better than a pander to the vices of the king, and privy to his dangerous secrets, exerted all his backstair influence to forward the promotion of Carr, by whom he was doubtless repaid in some way or other. Overbury did not confine his friendship to this, if friendship ever could exist between two such men, but acted the part of an entremetteur, and assisted Rochester to carry on an adulterous intrigue with the Lady Frances Howard, the wife of the Earl of Essex. This woman was a person of violent passions and lost to all sense of shame. Her husband was in her way, and to be freed from him she instituted proceedings for a divorce on grounds which a woman of any modesty or delicacy of feeling would die rather than avow. Her scandalous suit was successful and was no sooner decided than preparations on a scale of the greatest magnificence were made for her marriage with Lord Rochester. Sir Thomas Overbury, who had willingly assisted his patron to intrigue with the Countess of Essex, seems to have imagined that his marriage with so vile a woman might retard his advancement. He accordingly employed all his influence to dissuade him from it. But Rochester was bent on the match, and his passions were as violent as those of the Countess. On one occasion, when Overbury and the Viscount were walking in the gallery of Whitehall, Overbury was overheard to say, "Well, my lord, if you do marry that base woman, you will utterly ruin your honor and yourself. You shall never do it with my advice or consent. And if you do, you had best look to stand fast." Rochester flung from him in a rage, exclaiming with an oath, "I will be even with you for this." These words were the death warrant of the unfortunate Overbury. He had mortally wounded the pride of Rochester in insinuating that by his, Overbury's, means, he might be lowered in the king's favor, and he had endeavored to curb the burning passions of a heartless, dissolute, and reckless man. Overbury's imprudent remonstrances were reported to the Countess, and from that moment she also vowed the most deadly vengeance against him. With a fiendish hypocrisy, however, they both concealed their intentions, and Overbury, at the solicitation of Rochester, was appointed ambassador to the court of Russia. This apparent favor was but the first step in a deep and deadly plot. Rochester, pretending to be warmly attached to the interests of Overbury, advised him to refuse the embassy, which he said was but a trick to get him out of the way. He promised at the same time to stand between him and any evil consequences which might result from his refusal. Overbury fell into the snare and declined the embassy. James, offended, immediately ordered his committal to the Tower. He was now in safe custody, and his enemies had opportunity to commence the work of vengeance. The first thing Rochester did was to procure, by his influence at court, the dismissal of the lieutenant of the Tower and the appointment of Sir Jarvis Elwes, one of his creatures, to the vacant post. This man was but one instrument, and another being necessary was found in Richard Weston, a fellow who had formerly been shopman to a druggist. He was installed in the office of underkeeper, and as such had the direct custody of Overbury. So far, all was favorable to the designs of the conspirators. In the meantime, the insidious Rochester wrote the most friendly letters to Overbury, requesting him to bear his ill fortune patiently, and promising that his imprisonment should not be of long duration, for that his friends were exerting themselves to soften the king's displeasure. Still pretending the extreme sympathy for him, he followed up the letters by presents of pastry and other delicacies, which could not be procured in the Tower. These articles were all poisoned. Occasionally, presents of a similar description were sent to Sir Jarvis Elwes, with the understanding that these articles were not poisoned when they were unaccompanied by letters. Of these, the unfortunate prisoner never tasted. A woman named Turner, who had formerly kept a house of ill fame and who had more than once lent it to further the guilty intercourse of Rochester and Lady Essex, was the agent employed to procure the poisons. They were prepared by Dr. Foreman, a pretended fortune-teller of Lambeth, assisted by an apothecary named Franklin. Both these persons knew for what purposes the poisons were needed and employed their skill in mixing them in the pastry and other edibles in such small quantities as gradually to wear out the constitution of their victim. Mrs. Turner regularly furnished the poisoned articles to the underkeeper, who placed them before Overbury. Not only his food, but his drink was poisoned. Arsenic was mixed with the salt he ate, and cantharides with the pepper. All this time his health declined sensibly. Daily he grew weaker and weaker, and with a sickly appetite craved for sweets and jellies. Rochester continued to condole with him, and anticipated all his wants in this respect, sending him abundance of pastry and occasionally partridges and other game, and young pigs. With the sauce for the game, Mrs. Turner mixed a quantity of cantharides and poisoned the pork with lunar caustic. As stated on the trial, Overbury took in this manner poison enough to have poisoned 20 men, but his constitution was strong, and he still lingered. Franklin, the apothecary, confessed that he prepared with Dr. Foreman 7 different sorts of poisons, viz., aquafortis, arsenic, mercury, powder of diamonds, lunar caustic, great spiders, and cantharides. Overbury held out so long that Rochester became impatient, and in a letter to Lady Essex expressed his wonder that things were not sooner dispatched. Orders were immediately sent by Lady Essex to the keeper to finish with the victim at once. Overbury had not been all this time without suspicion of treachery, although he appears to have had no idea of poison. He merely suspected that it was intended to confine him for life and to set the king still more bitterly against him. In one of his letters he threatened Rochester that unless he were speedily liberated, he would expose his villainy to the world. He says, "You and I, ere it be long, will come to a public trial of another nature. Drive me not to extremities, lest I should say something that both you and I should repent. Whether I live or die, your shame shall never die, but ever remain to the world to make you the most odious man living. I wonder much you should neglect him to whom such secrets of all kinds have been passed. Be these the fruits of common secrets, common dangers?" All these remonstrances and hints as to the dangerous secrets in his keeping were ill calculated to serve him with a man so reckless as Lord Rochester. They were more likely to cause him to be sacrificed than to be saved. Rochester appears to have acted as if he thought so. He doubtless employed the murderer's reasoning that dead men tell no tales, when, after receiving letters of this description, he complained to his paramour of the delay. Weston was spurred on to consummate the atrocity, and the patience of all parties being exhausted, a dose of corrosive sublimate was administered to him in October 1613, which put an end to his sufferings after he had been for 6 months in their hands. On the very day of his death and before his body was cold, he was wrapped up carelessly in a sheet and buried without any funeral ceremony in a pit within the precincts of the Tower. Sir Anthony Weldon, in his Court and Character of James I, gives a somewhat different account of the closing scene of this tragedy. He says, "Franklin and Weston came into Overbury's chamber and found him in infinite torment, with contention between the strength of nature and the working of the poison. And it being very like that nature had gotten the better in this contention by the thrusting out of boils, blotches, and blains, they, fearing it might come to light by the judgment of physicians, the foul play that had been offered him, consented to stifle him with the bedclothes, which accordingly was performed. And so ended his miserable life, with the assurance of the conspirators that he died by the poison, none thinking otherwise than these two murderers." The sudden death, the indecent haste of the funeral, and the non-holding of an inquest upon the body strengthened the suspicions that were afloat. Rumor, instead of whispering, began to speak out, and the relatives of the deceased openly expressed their belief that their kinsman had been murdered. But Rochester was still all-powerful at court, and no one dared to utter a word to his discredit. Shortly afterwards, his marriage with the Countess of Essex was celebrated with the utmost splendor, the king himself being present at the ceremony. It would seem that Overbury's knowledge of James's character was deeper than Rochester had given him credit for, and that he had been a true prophet when he predicted that his marriage would eventually estrange James from his minion. At this time, however, Rochester stood higher than ever in the royal favor. But it did not last long. Conscience, that busy monitor, was at work. The tongue of rumor was never still, and Rochester, who had long been a guilty, became at last a wretched man. His cheeks lost their color, his eyes grew dim, and he became moody, careless, and melancholy. The king, seeing him thus, took at length no pleasure in his society, and began to look about for another favorite. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, was the man to his mind. Quick-witted, handsome, and unscrupulous. The two latter qualities alone were sufficient to recommend him to James I. In proportion as the influence of Rochester declined, that of Buckingham increased. A falling favorite has no friends, and rumor wagged her tongue against Rochester louder and more pertinaciously than ever. A new favorite, too, generally endeavors to hasten by a kick the fall of the old one. And Buckingham, anxious to work the complete ruin of his forerunner in the king's good graces, encouraged the relatives of Sir Thomas Overbury to prosecute their inquiries into the strange death of their kinsman. James was rigorous enough in the punishment of offenses when he was not himself involved. He piqued himself, moreover, on his dexterity in unraveling mysteries. The affair of Sir Thomas Overbury found him congenial occupation. He set to work by ordering the arrest of Sir Gervas Elwes. James, at this early stage of the proceedings, does not seem to have been aware that Rochester was so deeply implicated. Struck with horror at the atrocious system of slow poisoning, the king sent for all the judges. According to Sir Anthony Weldon, he knelt down in the midst of them and said, "My lords, the judges, it is late come to my hearing that you have now in examination a business of poisoning. Lord, in what a miserable condition shall this kingdom be, the only famous nation for hospitality in the world, if our tables should become such a snare as that none could eat without danger of life, and that Italian custom should be introduced among us. Therefore, my lords, I charge you, as you will answer it at that great and dreadful day of judgment, that you examine it strictly, without favor, affection, or partiality. And if you should spare any guilty of this crime, God's curse light on you and your posterity. And if I spare any that are guilty, God's curse light on me and my posterity forever." The imprecation fell but too surely upon the devoted house of Stuart. The solemn oath was broken, and God's curse did light upon him and his posterity. The next person arrested after Sir Gervas Elwes was Weston, the underkeeper. Then Franklin and Mrs. Turner, and lastly the Earl and Countess of Somerset, to which dignity Rochester had been advanced since the death of Overbury. Weston was the first brought to trial. Public curiosity was on the stretch. Nothing else was talked of, and the court on the day of trial was crowded to suffocation. The state trials report that Lord Chief Justice Cook laid open to the jury the baseness and cowardliness of poisoners, who attempt that secretly against which there is no means of preservation or defense for a man's life. And how rare it was to hear of any poisoning in England, so detestable it was to our nation. But the devil had taught divers to be cunning in it, so that they can poison in what distance of space they please, by consuming the nativum calidum, or humidum radicale, in 1 month, 2 or 3, or more, as they list, which they 4 manner of ways do execute, viz. Haustu, gustu, odore, and contactu. When the indictment was read over, Weston made no other reply than, "Lord, have mercy upon me! Lord, have mercy upon me!" On being asked how he would be tried, he refused to throw himself upon a jury of his country, and declared that he would be tried by God alone. In this he persisted for some time. The fear of the dreadful punishment for contumacy induced him at length to plead not guilty and take his trial in due course of law. The punishment for the contumacious was expressed by the words onere, frigore, et fame. By the first was meant that the culprit should be extended on his back on the ground and weights placed over his body, gradually increased until he expired. Sometimes the punishment was not extended to this length, and the victim, being allowed to recover, underwent the second portion, the frigore, which consisted in his standing naked in the open air for a certain space, in the sight of all the people. The third, or fame, was more dreadful, the statute saying that he was to be preserved with the coarsest bread that could be got, and water out of the next sink or puddle to the place of execution. And that day he had water, he should have no bread, and that day he had bread, he should have no water. And in this torment he was to linger as long as nature would hold out. All the circumstances against him were fully proved, and he was found guilty and executed at Tyburn. Mrs. Turner, Franklin, and Sir Jarvis Elwes were also brought to trial, found guilty and executed between the 19th of October and the 4th of December 1615. But the grand trial of the Earl and Countess of Somerset did not take place till the month of May following. On the trial of Sir Jarvis Elwes, circumstances had transpired showing a guilty knowledge of the poisoning on the part of the Earl of Northampton, the uncle of Lady Somerset, and the chief Faulkner, Sir Thomas Monson. The former was dead, but Sir Thomas Monson was arrested and brought to trial. It appeared, however, that he was too dangerous a man to be brought to the scaffold. He knew too many of the odious secrets of James I, and his dying speech might contain disclosures which would compromise the king. To conceal old guilt, it was necessary to incur new. The trial of Sir Thomas Monson was brought to an abrupt conclusion, and himself set at liberty. Already James had broken his oath. He now began to fear that he had been rash in engaging so zealously to bring the poisoners to punishment. That Somerset would be declared guilty there was no doubt, and that he looked for pardon and impunity was equally evident to the king. Somerset, while in the Tower, asserted confidently that James would not dare to bring him to trial. In this he was mistaken. But James was in an agony. What the secret was between them will now never be known with certainty, but it may be surmised. Some have imagined it to be the vice to which the king was addicted, while others have asserted that it related to the death of Prince Henry, a virtuous young man who had held Somerset in special abhorrence. This prince died early, unlamented by his father, and, as public opinion whispered at the time, poisoned by Somerset. Probably some crime or other lay heavy upon the soul of the king. And Somerset, his accomplice, could not be brought to public execution with safety. Hence the dreadful tortures of James when he discovered that his favorite was so deeply implicated in the murder of Overbury. Every means was taken by the agonized king to bring the prisoner into what was called a safe frame of mind. He was secretly advised to plead guilty and trust to the clemency of the king. The same advice was conveyed to the countess. Bacon was instructed by the king to draw up a paper of all the points of mercy and favor to Somerset which might result from the evidence, and Somerset was again recommended to plead guilty and promised that no evil should ensue to him. The Countess was first tried. She trembled and shed tears during the reading of the indictment, and in a low voice pleaded guilty. On being asked why sentence of death should not be passed against her, she replied meekly, "I can much aggravate, but nothing extenuate my fault. I desire mercy, and that the lords will intercede for me with the king." Sentence of death was passed upon her. Next day the earl was brought to trial. He appears to have mistrusted the promises of James, and he pleaded not guilty. With a self-possession and confidence which he felt, probably from his knowledge of the king's character, he rigorously cross-examined the witnesses and made a stubborn defense. After a trial which lasted 11 hours, he was found guilty and condemned to the felon's death. Whatever may have been the secrets between the criminal and the king, the latter, notwithstanding his terrific oath, was afraid to sign the death warrant. It might perchance have been his own. The Earl and Countess were committed to the Tower, where they remained for nearly 5 years. At the end of this period, to the surprise and scandal of the community and the disgrace of its chief magistrate, they both received the royal pardon, but were ordered to reside at a distance from the court. Having been found guilty of felony, the estates of the Earl had become forfeited, but James granted him out of their revenues an income of £4,000 per annum. Shamelessness could go no further. Of the afterlife of these criminals, nothing is known, except that the love they had formerly borne each other was changed into aversion, and that they lived under the same roof for months together without the interchange of a word. The exposure of their atrocities did not put a stop to the practice of poisoning. On the contrary, as we shall see hereafter, it engendered that insane imitation which is so strange a feature of the human character. James himself is supposed, with great probability, to have fallen victim to it. In the notes to Harris's Life and Writings of James I, there is a good deal of information on the subject. The guilt of Buckingham, although not fully established, rests upon circumstances of suspicion stronger than have been sufficient to lead hundreds to the scaffold. His motives for committing the crime are stated to have been a desire for revenge for the coldness with which the king, in the latter years of his reign, began to regard him, his fear that James intended to degrade him, and his hope that the great influence he possessed over the mind of the heir apparent would last through a new reign if the old one were brought to a close. In the second volume of the Harleian Miscellany, there is a tract entitled The Forerunner of Revenge, written by George Eglisham, Doctor of Medicine, and one of the physicians to King James. Harris, in quoting it, says that it is full of rancor and prejudice. It is evidently exaggerated, but forms nevertheless a link in the chain of evidence. Eglisham says, "The king being sick of an ague, the duke took this opportunity, when all the king's doctors of physic were at dinner, and offered him a white powder to take, the which he a long time refused. But overcome with his flattering importunity, he took it in wine, and immediately became worse and worse, falling into many swoonings and pains and violent fluxes of the belly, so tormented that his majesty cried out aloud of this white powder, 'Would to God I had never taken it!' He then tells us of the Countess of Buckingham, the duke's mother, applying the plaster to the king's heart and breast, whereupon he grew faint and short-breathed and in agony, that the physicians exclaimed that the king was poisoned, that Buckingham commanded them out of the room and committed one of them close prisoner to his own chamber, and another to be removed from court, and that after his majesty's death his body and head swelled above measure, his hair with the skin of his head stuck to his pillow, and his nails became loose on his fingers and toes." Clarendon, who, by the way, was a partisan of the duke's, gives a totally different account of James's death. He says, "It was occasioned by an ague, after a short indisposition by the gout, which, meeting many humors in a fat, unwieldy body of 58 years old, in 4 or 5 fits carried him out of the world. After whose death many scandalous and libelous discourses were raised, without the least color or ground, as appeared upon the strictest and most malicious examination that could be made, long after, in a time of license, when nobody was afraid of offending majesty, and when prosecuting the highest reproaches and contumelies against the royal family was held very meritorious. Notwithstanding this confident declaration, the world will hardly be persuaded that there was not some truth in the rumors that were abroad. The inquiries which were instituted were not strict, as he asserts, and all the unconstitutional influence of the powerful favorite was exerted to defeat them. In the celebrated accusations brought against Buckingham by the Earl of Bristol, the poisoning of King James was placed last on the list, and the pages of history bear evidence of the summary mode in which they were, for the time, got rid of. The man from whom Buckingham is said to have procured his poisons was one Dr. Lamb, a conjurer and empiric who, besides dealing in poisons, pretended to be a fortune-teller. The popular fury, which broke with comparative harmlessness against his patron, was directed against this man until he could not appear with safety in the streets of London. His fate was melancholy. Walking one day in Cheapside, disguised, as he thought, from all observers, he was recognized by some idle boys, who began to hoot and pelt him with stones, calling out, "The poisoner! The poisoner! Down with the wizard! Down with him!" A mob very soon collected, and the doctor took to his heels and ran for his life. He was pursued and seized in Wood Street, and from thence dragged by the hair through the mire to St. Paul's Cross, the mob beating him with sticks and stones, and calling out, "Kill the wizard! Kill the poisoner!" Charles I, on hearing of the riot, rode from Whitehall to quell it, but he arrived too late to save the victim. Every bone in his body was broken, and he was quite dead. Charles was excessively indignant and fined the city £600 for its inability to deliver up the ringleaders to justice. But it was in Italy that poisoning was most prevalent. From a very early period, it seems to have been looked upon in that country as a perfectly justifiable means of getting rid of an enemy. The Italians of the 16th and 17th centuries poisoned their opponents with as little compunction as an Englishman of the present day brings an action at law against anyone who has done him an injury. The writings of contemporary authors inform us that when La Spara and La Tofania carried on their infernal trade, ladies put poison bottles on their dressing tables as openly and used them with as little scruple upon others as modern dames use eau de cologne or lavender water upon themselves. So powerful is the influence of fashion that it can even cause murder to be regarded as a venial peccadillo. In the memoirs of the last Duke of Guise, who made a quixotic attempt in 1648 to seize upon the government of Naples, we find some curious particulars relative to the popular feeling with regard to poisoning. A man named Gennaro Annese, who, after the short and extraordinary career of Masaniello, the fisherman, had established himself as a sort of captain general of the populace, rendered himself so obnoxious to the Duke of Guise that the adherents of the latter determined to murder him. The captain of the guard, as the Duke himself very coolly informs us, was requested to undertake this office. It was suggested to him that the poniard would be the most effectual instrument, but the man turned up his eyes with pious horror at the proposition. He was ready to poison Gennaro Annese whenever he might be called upon to do so, but to poniard him, he said, would be disgraceful and unbecoming an officer of the guards. At last, poison was agreed upon, and Augustino Mola, an attorney in the Duke's confidence, brought the bottle containing the liquid to show it to his master. The following is the Duke's own account. "Augustino came to me at night and told me, 'I have brought you something which will free you from Gennaro. He deserves death, and it is no great matter after what fashion justice is done upon him. Look at this vial, full of clear and beautiful water. In 4 days' time it will punish all his treasons. The captain of the guard has undertaken to give it to him, and as it has no taste at all, Gennaro will suspect nothing.' The Duke further informs us that the dose was duly administered, but that Gennaro, fortunately for himself, ate nothing for dinner that day but cabbage dressed with oil, which, acting as an antidote, caused him to vomit profusely and saved his life. He was exceedingly ill for 5 days, but never suspected that he had been poisoned. In process of time, poison vending became a profitable trade. 11 years after this period, it was carried on at Rome to such an extent that the sluggish government was roused to interference. Beckmann in his History of Inventions, and Lebret in his Magazin zum Gebrauche der Staatenkirche Geschichte, or Magazine of Materials for a History of a State Church, relates that in the year 1659 it was made known to Pope Alexander VII that great numbers of young women had avowed in the confessional that they had poisoned their husbands with slow poisons. The Catholic clergy, who in general hold the secrets of the confessional so sacred, were shocked and alarmed at the extraordinary prevalence of the crime. Although they refrained from revealing the names of the penitents, they conceived themselves bound to apprise the head of the church of the enormities that were practiced. It was also the subject of general conversation in Rome that young widows were unusually abundant. It was remarked, too, that if any couple lived unhappily together, the husband soon took ill and died. The papal authorities, when once they began to inquire, soon learned that a society of young wives had been formed and met nightly for some mysterious purpose at the house of an old woman named Hieronyma Spara. This hag was a reputed witch and fortune-teller and acted as president of the young viragos, several of whom, it was afterwards ascertained, belonged to the first families of Rome. In order to have positive evidence of the practices of this female conclave, a lady was employed by the government to seek an interview with them. She dressed herself out in the most magnificent style, and having been amply provided with money, she found but little difficulty, when she had stated her object, of procuring an audience of La Spara and her sisterhood. She pretended to be in extreme distress of mind on account of the infidelities and ill-treatment of her husband, and implored La Spara to furnish her with a few drops of the wonderful elixir, the efficacy of which in sending cruel husbands to their last long sleep was so much vaunted by the ladies of Rome. La Spara fell into the snare and sold her some of her drops at a price commensurate with the supposed wealth of the purchaser. The liquor thus obtained was subjected to an analysis and found to be, as was suspected, a slow poison, clear, tasteless, and limpid, like that spoken of by the Duke of Guise. Upon this evidence, the house was surrounded by the police, and La Spara and her companions taken into custody. La Spara, who is described as having been a little ugly old woman, was put to the torture, but obstinately refused to confess her guilt. Another of the women, named La Gratiosa, had less firmness and laid bare all the secrets of the infernal sisterhood. Taking a confession extorted by anguish on the rack at its true value, nothing at all, there is still sufficient evidence to warrant posterity in the belief of their guilt. They were found guilty and condemned, according to their degrees of culpability, to various punishments. La Spara, Gratiosa, and 3 young women who had poisoned their husbands were hanged together at Rome. Upwards of 30 women were whipped publicly through the streets, and several whose high ranks screened them from more degrading punishment were banished from the country and mulcted in heavy fines. In a few months afterwards, 9 women more were hanged for poisoning, and another bevy, including many young and beautiful girls, were whipped half-naked through the streets of Rome. This severity did not put a stop to the practice, and jealous women and avaricious men, anxious to step into the inheritance of fathers, uncles, or brothers, resorted to poison. As it was quite free from taste, color, and smell, it was administered without exciting suspicion. The skillful vendors compounded it of different degrees of strength, so that the poisoners had only to say whether they wanted their victims to die in a week, a month, or 6 months, and they were suited with corresponding doses. The vendors were chiefly women, of whom the most celebrated was a hag named Tophania, who was in this way accessory to the death of upwards of 600 persons. This woman appears to have been a dealer in poisons from her girlhood, and resided first at Palermo and then at Naples. That entertaining traveler, Father Labat, has given in his letters from Italy many curious particulars relating to her. When he was at Civitavecchia in 1719, the viceroy of Naples discovered that poison was extensively sold in the latter city, and that it went by the name of Aqueta, or Little Water. On making further inquiry, he ascertained that Tophania, who was by this time near 70 years of age, and who seems to have begun her evil courses very soon after the execution of La Spara, sent large quantities of it to all parts of Italy in small vials, with the inscription, Manna of St. Nicholas of Bari. The tomb of St. Nicholas of Bari was celebrated throughout Italy. A miraculous oil was said to ooze from it, which cured nearly all the maladies that flesh is heir to, provided the recipient made use of it with the due degree of faith. La Tophania artfully gave this name to her poison to elude the vigilance of the custom house officers, who, in common with everybody else, had a pious respect for St. Nicholas de Bari and his wonderful oil. The poison was similar to that manufactured by La Spara. Hahnemann, the physician and father of the homeopathic doctrine, writing upon this subject, says it was compounded of arsenical neutral salts, occasioning in the victim a gradual loss of appetite, faintness, gnawing pains in the stomach, loss of strength, and wasting of the lungs. The Abbe Gagliardi says that a few drops of it were generally poured into tea, chocolate, or soup, and its effects were slow and almost imperceptible. Garelli, physician to the Emperor of Austria, in a letter to Hoffmann, says it was crystallized arsenic dissolved in a large quantity of water by decoction, with the addition, for some unexplained purpose, of the herb cymbalaria. The Neapolitans called it aqua tofnina, and it became notorious all over Europe under the name of aqua tofania. Although this woman carried on her infamous traffic so extensively, it was extremely difficult to meet with her. She lived in continual dread of discovery. She constantly changed her name and residence, and pretending to be a person of great godliness, resided in monasteries for months together. Whenever she was more than usually apprehensive of detection, she sought ecclesiastical protection. She was soon apprised of the search made for her by the Viceroy of Naples, and according to her practice, took refuge in a monastery. Either the search after her was not very rigid, or her measures were exceedingly well taken, for she contrived to elude the vigilance of the authorities for several years. What is still more extraordinary, as showing the ramifications of her system, her trade was still carried on to as great an extent as before. Lebas informs us that she had so great a sympathy for poor wives who hated their husbands and wanted to get rid of them, but could not afford to buy her wonderful aqua, that she made them presents of it. She was not allowed, however, to play at this game forever. She was at length discovered in a nunnery and her retreat cut off. The viceroy made several representations to the superior to deliver her up, but without effect. The abbess, supported by the archbishop of the diocese, constantly refused. The public curiosity was in consequence so much excited at the additional importance thus thrust upon the criminal that thousands of persons visited the nunnery in order to catch a glimpse of her. The patience of the viceroy appears to have been exhausted by these delays. Being a man of sense and not a very zealous Catholic, he determined that even the church should not shield a criminal so atrocious. Setting the privileges of the nunnery at defiance, he sent a troop of soldiers, who broke over the walls and carried her away viet armis. The archbishop, Cardinal Pignatelli, was highly indignant, and threatened to excommunicate and lay the whole city under interdict. All the inferior clergy, animated by the esprit du corps, took up the question, and so worked upon the superstitious and bigoted people that they were ready to rise in a mass to storm the palace of the viceroy and rescue the prisoner. These were serious difficulties, but the viceroy was not a man to be daunted. Indeed, he seems to have acted throughout with a rare union of astuteness, coolness, and energy. To avoid the evil consequences of the threatened excommunication, he placed a guard round the palace of the archbishop, judging that the latter would not be so foolish as to launch out an anathema which would cause the city to be starved, and himself in it. The market people would not have dared to come to the city with provisions so long as it remained under the ban. There would have been too much inconvenience to himself and his ghostly brethren in such a measure, and as the viceroy anticipated, the good cardinal reserved his thunders for some other occasion. Still, there was the populace. To quiet their clamor and avert the impending insurrection, the agents of the government adroitly mingled with the people and spread abroad a report that Tophania had poisoned all the wells and fountains of the city. This was enough. The popular feeling was turned against her immediately. Those who, but a moment before, had looked upon her as a saint, now reviled her as a devil and were as eager for her punishment as they had before been for her escape. Tophania was then put to the torture. She confessed the long catalogue of her crimes and named all the persons who had employed her. She was shortly afterwards strangled, and her corpse thrown over the wall into the garden of the convent from whence she had been taken. This appears to have been done to conciliate the clergy, by allowing them at least the burial of one who had taken refuge within their precincts. After her death, the mania for poisoning seems to have abated, but we have yet to see what hold it took upon the French people at a somewhat earlier period. So rooted had it become in France between the years 1670 and 1680 that Madame de Sévigné, in one of her letters, expresses her fear that Frenchman and poisoner would become synonymous terms. As in Italy, the first notice the government received of the prevalence of this crime was given by the clergy, to whom females of high rank and some among the middle and lower classes had avowed in the confessional that they had poisoned their husbands. In consequence of these disclosures, two Italians, named Exili and Glaser, were arrested and thrown into the Bastille on the charge of compounding and selling the drugs used for these murders. Glaser died in prison, but Exili remained without trial for several months. And there, shortly afterwards, he made the acquaintance of another prisoner, named Sainte-Croix, by whose example the crime was still further disseminated among the French people. The most notorious of the poisoners that derived their pernicious knowledge from this man was Madame de Brinvilliers, a young woman connected both by birth and marriage with some of the noblest families of France. She seems, from her very earliest years, to have been heartless and depraved, and, if we may believe her own confession, was steeped in wickedness ere she had well entered her teens. She was, however, beautiful and accomplished, and in the eye of the world seemed exemplary and kind. Guillot de Pitaval, in the Cause Célèbre, and Madame de Sévigné in her letters, represent her as mild and agreeable in manners, and offering no traces on her countenance of the evil soul within. She was married in 1651 to the Marquis de Brinvilliers, with whom she lived unhappily for some years. He was a loose, dissipated character, and was the means of introducing Sainte-Croix to his wife, a man who cast a blight upon her life and dragged her on from crime to crime, till her offenses became so great that the mind shudders to dwell upon them. For this man she conceived a guilty passion, to gratify which she plunged at once into the gulf of sin. She was drawn to its most loathsome depths ere retribution overtook her. She had as yet shown a fair outside to the world, and found but little difficulty in effecting a legal separation from her husband, who had not the art to conceal his vices. The proceeding gave great offense to her family. She appears after this to have thrown off the mask completely, and carried on her intrigues so openly with her lover, Sainte-Croix, that her father, Monsieur d'Aubray, scandalized at her conduct, procured a lettre de cachet, and had him imprisoned in the Bastille for a twelvemonth. Sainte-Croix, who had been in Italy, was a dabbler in poisons. He knew something of the secrets of the detestable Laspara, and improved himself in them from the instructions of Exili, with whom he speedily contracted a sort of friendship. By him he was shown how to prepare not only the liquid poisons employed in Italy, but that known as succession powder, which afterwards became so celebrated in France. Like his mistress, he appeared amiable, witty, and intelligent, and showed no signs to the world of the two fierce passions, revenge and avarice, which were gnawing at his heart. Both these passions were to be sated on the unfortunate family of Dobray, his revenge because they had imprisoned him, and his avarice because they were rich. Reckless and extravagant, he was always in want of money and had no one to supply him but Madame de Brinvilliers, whose own portion was far from sufficient to satisfy his need. Groaning to think that any impediment should stand between him and wealth, he conceived the horrid idea of poisoning Monsieur Dobray, her father, and her two brothers, that she might inherit the property. Three murders were nothing to such a villain. He communicated his plan to Madame de Brinvilliers, and she, without the slightest scruple, agreed to aid him. He undertook to compound the poisons, and she to administer them. The zeal and alacrity with which she set to work seem hardly credible. Sainte Croix found her an apt scholar, and she soon became as expert as himself in the manufacture of poisons. To try the strength of the first doses, she used to administer them to dogs, rabbits, and pigeons. Afterwards, wishing to be more certain of their effects, she went round to the hospitals and administered them to the sick poor in the soups which she brought in apparent charity. None of the poisons were intended to kill at the first dose, so that she could try them once upon an individual without fear of murder. She tried the same atrocious experiment upon the guests at her father's table by poisoning a pigeon pie. To be more certain still, she next poisoned herself. When convinced by this desperate essay of the potency of the draught, she procured an antidote from Sainte Croix, and all doubts being removed, commenced operations upon her gray-headed father. She administered the first dose with her own hands in his chocolate. The poison worked well. The old man was taken ill, and his daughter, apparently full of tenderness and anxiety, watched by his bedside. The next day she gave him some broth, which she recommended as highly nourishing. This also was poisoned. In this manner she gradually wore out his frame, and in less than 10 days he was a corpse. His death seemed so much the result of disease that no suspicions were excited. When the two brothers arrived from the provinces to render the last sad duties to their sire, they found their sister as grieved to all outward appearance as even filial affection could desire. But the young men only came to perish. They stood between Sainte Croix and the already half-clutched gold, and their doom was sealed. A man named Lachaussee was hired by Sainte Croix to aid in administering the poisons, and in less than 6 weeks' time they had both gone to their long home. Suspicion was now excited, but so cautiously had all been done that it found no one upon whom to attach itself. The Marquise had a sister, and she was entitled, by the death of her relatives, to half the property. Less than the whole would not satisfy Sainte Croix, and he determined that she should die the same death as her father and brothers. She was too distrustful, however, and by quitting Paris, she escaped the destruction that was lurking for her. The Marquise had undertaken these murders to please her lover. She was now anxious to perpetrate another on her own account. She wished to marry Sainte Croix, but though separated from her husband, she was not divorced. She thought it would be easier to poison him than to apply to the tribunals for a divorce which might perhaps be refused. But Sainte Croix had no longer any love for his guilty instrument. Bad men do not admire others who are as bad as themselves. Though a villain himself, he had no desire to marry one, and was not at all anxious for the death of the Marquis. He seemed, however, to enter into the plot, and supplied her with poison for her husband, but he took care to provide a remedy. La Brinvilliers poisoned him one day, and Sainte Croix gave him an antidote the next. In this manner he was buffeted about between them for some time, and finally escaped, with a ruined constitution and a broken heart. But the day of retribution was at hand, and a terrible mischance brought the murders to light. The nature of the poisons compounded by Sainte Croix was so deadly that, when working in his laboratory, he was obliged to wear a mask to preserve himself from suffocation. One day the mask slipped off, and the miserable wretch perished in his crimes. His corpse was found on the following morning in the obscure lodging where he had fitted up his laboratory. As he appeared to be without friends or relatives, the police took possession of his effects. Among other things was found a small box to which was affixed the following singular document. I humbly beg that those into whose hands this box may fall will do me the favor to deliver it into the hands only of the Marchioness de Brinvilliers, who resides in the Rue Neuve-Saint-Paul, as everything it contains concerns her and belongs to her alone, and as, besides, there is nothing in it that can be of use to any person but her.